with stronger links to England over the centuries. The Welsh language is less universally spoken, but you're still aware of being in a different country. To get the most of this sensation, go there on a day when the Welsh national rugby team is playing a match against England. The rivalry is as intense as any in the world, as is the pride the Welsh people feel in their distinctiveness.
Lecture 17, The North of England.
The North of England has regional accents so different from those of the South that it's not always easy for people from one area to know what people from the other area are saying. Yorkshire and Lancashire, the big counties on the east and west side of the central Pennine Hills, each have distinctive accents. Different again, and often hard to follow if you're not from there, is the Geordie voice of people from Northumberland and Durham. Regional traditions remain strong. Northerners regard themselves as superior to Southerners. But within the North, neighbouring towns often have bitter rivalries fed by support for competing football teams, like those from Newcastle-upon-Tyne and Sunderland, or those from Manchester and Liverpool. The Pennine Hills are the defining characteristic of the North. Not very high, especially by European and American standards. They are nevertheless wild. This is Wuthering Heights country. The rural areas are mainly upland sheep farms, crisscrossed by dry stone walls, and now largely protected as national parks. The valleys are the heartland of England's Industrial Revolution. In the 1800s, the North was the dynamo of English industrialisation, led by the cities of Manchester, Bradford, Halifax and Leeds. It was a land of coal mines, blast furnaces, forges and textile mills. One characteristic novel of the era, Elizabeth Gaskell's North and South, describes a gentle southern girl's amazement when her family moves from the soft rural South to the harsh and smoky North, to a town where working men are fighting the class war in deadly earnest. The region's reputation spread all over the world. Manchester, New Hampshire, got its name from businessmen eager to emulate the energy of the English Manchester's industrial success. In the 20th century, by contrast, the North succumbed to foreign competition. Globalization and low wages in emerging industrial countries undercut its supremacy. And one by one, the mills, mines and factories closed. It was severely environmentally degraded, and then it began to suffer economic decline. A bad situation deteriorated further when Margaret Thatcher denationalised the heavy industries of the region, forcing its many unprofitable mines and factories to close. If you've seen the 1997 movie The Full Monty, you'll remember that the setting is Sheffield, an old iron and steel-making town whose men are now mired in chronic long-term unemployment. Comical on the surface, its setting is one of dismay and decline. Neither is the decline all that recent. Already by the 1930s, the North was finding it hard to compete. One wonderful book about the area is George Orwell's The Road to Wigan Pier, a report of his travels in the region on behalf of his fellow English socialists. Among the many memorable passages is this one, where he compares the degraded landscape in the towns to the delightful landscape between them. The train bore me away through the monstrous scenery of slag heaps, chimneys, piled scrap iron, foul canals, paths of cindery mud crisscrossed by the prints of clogs. We passed row after row of little grey slum houses running at right angles to the embankment. But quite soon, the train drew away into open country. And that seemed strange, almost unnatural, as though the open country had been a kind of park. For in the industrial areas, one always feels that the smoke and filth must go on forever, and that no part of the earth's surface can escape them. In spite of hard trying, man has not yet succeeded in doing his dirt everywhere. The earth is so vast and still so empty that even in the filthy heart of civilization, you find fields where the grass is green instead of grey. Another place to see this juxtaposition of the green with the grimy is the beautiful 1963 film Billy Liar, about a dreamy young man in a gaunt industrial town who escapes occasionally into the hills above. Begin your tour of the North in Liverpool, where the local Scouse accent sounds something like this.
Liverpool is a port whose River Mersey opens onto the Irish Sea. It has a long history of trade with the rest of the world and became rich as a centre of the Atlantic slave trade in the 1700s. Cotton from the American South poured into Liverpool before moving to the textile towns of Lancashire and Yorkshire. Opening of the Liverpool and Manchester Railway in 1830 boosted this trade. It was the first railway in the world to have locomotives running at 30 miles an hour. In the 1840s and 50s, it became a heavily Irish town as refugees from the famine flocked in. 100 years later, in the 1950s, 1960s, it became the centre of a musical sensation, the Mersey Beat, led by the Beatles.
All the most distinctive buildings in today's Liverpool are from the early 20th century. A dignified cluster at the waterfront is known as the Three Graces. The first of these graces, the Port of Liverpool building, was opened in 1907, in the era of King Edward VII, when the British people still believed in their destiny and duty to dominate the rest of the world. It's a spectacular mix of styles that goes by the name of Edwardian Baroque, blending a dome, reminiscent of St. Paul's Cathedral, with the columns of a Greek temple, and all on a Wagnerian scale. Superbly restored since 2000, its dazzling white Portland stone is visible once again, and now you can visit the rotunda inside. Spend some time looking at the exterior decorations too, which include mermaids, anchors, shells, and ship's bells, along with a pair of dolphins supporting the globe. Nearby is the Royal Liver Building from 1911. It's an office block, but it's historically important because it's generally recognised as the first reinforced concrete building in Britain. What a gorgeous place it is, with two proud towers and two domes just beneath and in front of them. The third of the graces is the Cunard Building, an office block inspired by palaces of the Italian Renaissance, but many times bigger. It was built during World War I and was headquarters of the most famous transatlantic liner company. The Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth were designed there, and this was the building to which passengers would report for their Atlantic crossings. I mentioned in an earlier lecture the modest homes in which the Beatles grew up, all fairly close to the centre of Liverpool. The Cavern Club, where they played before becoming world famous, is still going strong as a live music venue. The other two buildings most deserving of your attention are the two cathedrals, Anglican and Catholic, standing half a mile apart along the aptly named Hope Street. The Anglican Cathedral was begun at the same time as the Three Graces, at the high watermark of England's imperial self-confidence. Designed by a very youthful Giles Gilbert Scott and consecrated in the 1920s, its neo-Gothic style makes it look much older than it is in fact. Be astonished by its sheer size, cavernous, and built according to a unified design, it lacks the interior variety of the medieval Gothic cathedrals, whose designs often changed over the 100 or more years of their building. It also lacks any sense of intimacy, and to enter is to feel dwarfed by something whose whole scale is overwhelming. To make matters worse, the walls and vaults are built of dark red sandstone, which seems to swallow up the available light. Even the massive stained glass windows can't compensate for the feeling of gloom and insignificance that besets you. White Portland stone would have made it much more hospitable. Despite these negative remarks, I still think it's impressive, and perhaps a transfiguration in stone of the hard-faced men who made Liverpool rich. The Catholic Liverpool Metropolitan Cathedral was intended to be a rival in scale to its Anglican counterpart. In fact, Archbishop Downey, the Irish-born leader of Liverpool's Catholics from the 1920s to the 50s, wanted it to be the best and biggest church in the world, outstripping even St. Peter's in Rome. He commissioned the non-Catholic Edwin Lutyens, the star architect of the era, whose design aimed to do just that. Unfortunately, the harsh economic realities of the Great Depression, when building started, made it impossible, and building came to a stop when the Second World War began. Liverpool, a major dockyard and maritime centre, suffered severe bomb damage. Another start in the 1950s faltered, so it wasn't until 1967 that the final work was done, 34 years after the foundations were laid, and according to yet another design, this time ultra-modernist. It looks like a cross between a vast Native American teepee and a spaceship with a crown on top. In fact, one of its nicknames is the Pope's Wigwam. The big open interior is circular, with the altar in the centre, to correspond with the Catholic Church's new idea of itself in the 1960s as less hierarchical and more communal. The circular lantern, or skylight, above the altar is finished in stained glass, which creates a luminous glow in the interior, especially on sunny days. As with so many modernist constructions, it was brave and distinctive, but it didn't work quite right. From the beginning, the aluminium roof leaked, while mosaic tiles cracked and fell from the walls. No sooner had it been consecrated than repair crews had to get busy. There's a fascinating photo in a basement display about the cathedral's history, which shows a member of the local archery club firing arrows at loose ceiling tiles to bring them down, rather than have them fall. The basement itself, immense, spacious and vaulted, feels like part of a completely different building. That's because it's the one part of the original design that was finished, according to Lutyens' original plans. From Liverpool, travel 30 miles east to Manchester, another Lancashire city, but one whose local accent is very different from that of Liverpool.
It was the powerhouse city of the Industrial Revolution, the marvel of its age, as it swelled from being a rustic village in the 1750s to a world-leading state-of-the-art manufacturing centre in 1800. Supporters of industrialisation loved it. Detractors hated it. Everyone agreed, however, that it was dirty, smoky, and by our standards, unendurably polluted.
Friedrich Engels wrote a powerful condemnation of it in his book, The Condition of the English Working Class, from 1845. Here's what he had to say about Manchester's River Irk. "It is a narrow, coal-black, foul-smelling stream, full of debris and refuse, which it deposits on the shallower right bank. In dry weather, a long string of the most disgusting, blackish-green slime pools are left standing on this bank, from the depths of which bubbles of miasmatic gas constantly arise and give forth a stench unendurable, even on the bridge 40 or 50 feet above the surface of the stream." I'm happy to be able to tell you that this is no longer an accurate description of the River Irk. In the early 1800s, Manchester had no representation in Parliament. The factory owners were aggrieved because they thought their interests were not adequately represented. And the workers were aggrieved because they had no votes and were forbidden to create trade unions. The wave of fear that had swept through Britain after the French Revolution had led to passage of repressive legislation against workers' combinations. Agitation for political reform after 1815 led to great demonstrations. At one on St. Peter's Fields, then an open area in the middle of Manchester, a pro-reform demonstration of unarmed men and women was attacked by mounted soldiers brandishing sabres. This was in August of 1819. 15 demonstrators were killed and several hundred slashed and maimed. The event shocked public opinion nationwide. It was nicknamed the Peterloo Massacre, a parody of Waterloo, where 4 years before, British soldiers had won a great victory over Napoleon. The Peterloo Massacre is to England what Lexington and Concord are to America, symbolic moments in the struggle for freedom and democracy. On the site was built Free Trade Hall, centre of a great 19th century movement to get rid of tariff barriers. Unfortunately, Free Trade Hall is now a hotel, though its mid-Victorian facade has been preserved and gives you a fine sense of the civic pride that went into its construction. Manchester's Town Hall, built in 1877, has been cleaned and looks marvellous. It's a Victorian Gothic building designed to look as though it dates back to the Middle Ages and has a religious function, while actually being the home of down-to-earth politicians. Inside, in the Great Hall, a series of pre-Raphaelite paintings by Ford Madox Brown tell the story of the city. To tour the building is to discover a wonderful, almost fairyland quality to its staircases and hallways, all of which have been decorated far beyond what's necessary in the name of civic pride. Statues of the city's dignitaries adorn every major corridor, and the polychromatic tiles are bright and intricate. The same is true of another spectacular neo-Gothic building nearby, the John Rylands Library, which is not only a pleasure to enter, but also has one of the greatest collections in Britain, including an original Gutenberg Bible. It too feels as much ecclesiastical as civic or educational. From the great industrial cities, drive northeast into the Pennines, being sure to stop off for an hour or two at Haworth, the village where the Bronte sisters spent most of their lives. Yorkshire, too, has its own distinctive voice.
Here, on a wild stretch of moorland, an hour to the north, you'll come to the starkly beautiful Ribblehead Viaduct, an object rich in history and controversy. It was built in the early 1870s when the Midland Railway Company was looking for a way to extend its lines all the way to the Scottish border. Other companies had already taken the easier lowland routes up the east and west coasts, leaving the Midland to build this much more mountainous stretch between Settle and Carlisle. Ribblehead was one big challenge. Tunnels were another. To build them, a workman's settlement of nearly 2,000 people and 170 houses sprang up, of which only archaeological traces now remain. Itinerant canal and railway builders were called navvies, tough, hard-drinking men accustomed to harsh conditions. At Ribblehead, they quarried local stone, made and fired their own bricks in makeshift kilns, and built the viaduct, completing it in 1875.
Railway enthusiasts loved the Settle to Carlisle line, of which this was the dramatic high point. It was the perfect place to take atmospheric photographs of steam locomotives working hard on the steep grades. They were dismayed when the railway decided to close the line in 1983, citing the very high cost of necessary repairs to the viaduct. Love of railway heritage is a quasi-religious passion to thousands of Britons, some of them influential. And they were able to gain parliamentary approval in 1989 to save the line and the viaduct. The repairs cost £3 million. The line reopened, and trains once more rumble across, albeit at low speed, including plenty of steam locomotive-drawn weekend specials. Ribblehead is inside the Yorkshire Dales National Park. The limestone country there has many distinctive waterfalls. The best known is Malham Cove, a beautiful arc of rock over which, when it's wet, the river falls 230 feet. The Pennine Way, a great footpath that meanders up the backbone of England, passes through Malham. The impressive formations prompted the makers of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows to film a scene at Malham. Not far away, also close to the Pennine Way, is another waterfall, Hardraw Force. The catch with this one is that it stands on private land, and the only way to get to it is through a pub, the Green Dragon, where you have to pay a small entry fee. It's worth the price, however, because the waterfall has created a dramatic semicircular overhang where softer rock has eroded faster than the limestone band at the top. As you approach the free-falling water, you're aware that millions of tons of rock loom over your head and that the place looks the way it does because they've been falling for centuries. The Green Dragon itself is an extremely attractive little pub with low ceilings, a cosy fireplace, and eccentric but likeable decorations. I had lunch there after seeing the falls. The great ancient city of the English North is York. Archaeological findings show it to have been occupied for thousands of years, and it was already an old settlement when the Romans built a fort there named Eboracum in 71 AD. It was the centre of the Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Northumbria, but was overrun by the Vikings in 866. They called it Jorvik, which is now the name of a museum that mixes genuine artifacts from local excavations with costumed reenactors and animatronic Viking robots who act as warriors, blacksmiths, leather makers, and irritable women. Kids love it, and I recall feeling a guilty pleasure years ago when I boarded the museum's so-called time travel capsule, which hurtled me back in time to the crucial year 866. The Viking exhibits at the nearby Yorkshire Museum are more sober, but somehow more trustworthy than the ones you'll see in Jorvik. York's also the site of one of the greatest cathedrals in Britain, York Minster, containing more medieval stained glass than any other church in the country. The Great East Window dates back to the early 1400s. And consists of more than 300 panels, all recently restored. The Great West Window, with its superb stone tracery in the form of interwoven hearts, and nicknamed the Heart of Yorkshire, is even older, dating back to the 1330s. Medieval remains are as clearly visible in York as in any other British city. An old crooked street, the Shambles, has a fine series of medieval and Tudor-era buildings, whose upper floors are larger than their ground floors, so that they appear to lean towards each other over the narrow passage. Once a set of butcher's shops, hence the name, the Shambles, they're now souvenir shops and restaurants, but the preservation of their exterior gives visitors a good sense of what medieval streets looked like. Best of all of the medieval remnants are the several miles of the old city walls. They were based on Roman originals, extended in the 12th and 14th centuries, and restored as a visitor attraction in the 19th. Four great gatehouses, or bars, punctuate a walk around the walls, as does the Multangular Tower, which by some estimates dates back to the days of the Emperor Constantine. Last but not least, York is the home of the National Railway Museum, a mecca to enthusiasts who still grieve over the disappearance of regular service steam locomotives in 1968. I can't praise it too highly, and it's certainly the best museum of its kind in the world. When I visited last in 2013, the five preserved locomotives from the A4 class were all there. Mallard, the most illustrious of the five, is the all-time speed record holder for a steam locomotive, having reached 126 miles per hour back in 1938. Clever marketers named this event the Great Gathering. Thousands of men in late middle age, which is to say my exact contemporaries, crowded in and sighed with pleasure. From York, go north, all the way up to the border country between England and Scotland. Today, this is a pretty area, rural and mild. But a visit to Carlisle or to Berwick-upon-Tweed brings home the reality of a long, harsh history. That's because for centuries, the border was contested ground. These were the marches. Warlords from both sides, English and Scottish, fought back and forth, and some towns changed hands repeatedly. To make matters worse, organized bandits called the Rivers from the border country attacked the lands to their immediate south, creating a situation of chronic fear and uncertainty. The word bereaved comes from this experience. It means having suffered an attack by the Reavers. From this area of prolonged raiding, we also have the word blackmail, because demands for ransom or forced payments for the right to be left alone were common. At Beamish in County Durham, there's a wonderful example of a fortified farmhouse which was designed with these attacks in mind. The family could withdraw into a thick-walled house, bar the entrances and huddle inside, even if their cattle were seized by the raiders. Better than having family members carried off into slavery, which was the fate of many. The Archbishop of Glasgow got into such a rage about the Rivers in 1525 that he issued a memorable curse against them, more than 1,000 words long, ordering it to be read out in all the churches of his diocese. Here's a fragment of it.
I curse their head, and all the hairs of their head. I curse their feasts, their eyes, their mouth, their nose, their tongue, their teeth, their skull, their shoulders, their breast, their heart, their stomach, their back, their womb, their arms, their legs, their hands, their feet, and every like part of their body, from the top of their head to the soles of their feet, before and behind, within and without. May all the malevolent wishes and curses ever known since the beginning of the world to this hour light on them. May the malediction of God that fell upon Lucifer and all his fellows that cast them from the high heaven to the deep hell light upon them.
It may well be the most vengeful and explicit official outburst in British history. In 2001, a pair of artists named Gordon Young and Andy Altman collaborated on a project to engrave just over 300 words of the curse on a polished 14-ton granite boulder, which was then sited in a pedestrian subway beneath a busy road in Carlisle. It sits on a pavement inscribed with the names of the leading Rivers families and has itself become a bone of contention. Some Carlisle folk claimed that this cursing stone was bringing bad luck to the city. Foot and mouth disease broke out among cattle in the area. A flood damaged part of the city. And the local football team had such a bad season that it was relegated to a lower division. Might the stone have occult powers? The city council debated the question in 2005, decided to keep the cursing stone, and it's still there today. Very much worth a visit. The Bishop of Carlisle favoured leaving it, but added that the original curse was not a godly act, and that we are called to bless, not curse, even our enemies. Carlisle Castle, 100 yards from the cursing stone, is a red sandstone fortress that stood on the front lines of the border wars for centuries. Founded by King William II in 1092, and built up over the centuries until it was immensely strong, it endured a succession of sieges during the Wars of the Roses. It was often used as a prison, and intricate wall carvings still visible there are thought to be the work of either the prisoners themselves or of bored prison guards. For a while, the castle was commanded by Richard, Duke of Gloucester, who later became King Richard III. Royalists held it during an 8-month siege in the English Civil War, until, after eating every horse, dog and rat, they were starved into submission. Carlisle Castle was last fought over in 1745, during Bonnie Prince Charlie's uprising, but has remained in good condition ever since, continuously occupied as headquarters of the King's Own Royal Border Regiment. On the other side of the country, the North Sea shore, the Elizabethan-era fortifications at Berwick-upon-Tweed are even grander. They were built in the late 1500s to end an era in which the city had repeatedly changed hands between the English and the Scots, suffering frequent sieges and bombardments. Immense earthworks, strengthened with stone abutments, surround three quarters of the city. They're designed in such a way that attackers approaching would have to cross open ground under withering crossfire. Elizabeth I, over the course of her reign, spent more money on the Berwick fortifications than on any other defence project, more even than she spent on defeating the Spanish Armada. The battlements make a wonderful hike today, with great views over the sea, the city, and the handsome Royal Border Bridge that carries the London to Edinburgh Railway over the River Tweed. They are alarmingly unprotected. Take care if you're there with young children. There's nothing to stop them falling off the high parapet. Peace finally descended over the marches after King James VI of Scotland became King James I of England. This union of crowns meant that the same authorities were at work on both sides of the border, and they set about stamping out the rivers once and for all. With the brutality characteristic of the era, leading river chieftains were rounded up, many were tried and executed. And by 1610, a semblance of peace had come to the area after centuries of fighting. It's a peace that you can still enjoy today while visiting the picturesque remnants of the old chaos.
Lecture 18, The English Midlands.
The Midlands is probably the least well-known part of Britain, and the one that unwise travellers might be tempted to omit. It lacks the grandeur of London and the scenic magnificence of the Scottish Highlands, but it does have a fascinating heritage, much of which is now carefully preserved. It's my own home ground, and to me a source of particular pride. Densely populated, the Midlands encompasses the counties of Staffordshire, Derbyshire, Leicestershire, Nottinghamshire, Lincolnshire, Warwickshire, Worcestershire, Herefordshire and Shropshire, along with parts of Northamptonshire and the former county of Rutland. At its centre is the huge conurbation of Birmingham. The region has been industrial territory since the 1760s, centre of the metal trades, engine, car and railroad manufacture, and hub of Britain's network of canals. In the South Midlands, offsetting the industry, is the Cotswolds, an area of charming villages and gentle hills, the personification of rural England. Let's begin this visit in Stoke-on-Trent, a middle-sized Midlands town that used to be one of the most polluted places in the world. It and the towns around it are collectively referred to as the Potteries, because they've been centres of pottery making for centuries. The bottle-shaped brick kilns that can still be seen all over the town have been eclipsed by newer and cleaner technology. They used to spew out choking smoke that seriously reduced local life expectancy. The combination of clay and coal in the ground nearby contributed to Stoke's early specialisation. The arrival on the scene of Josiah Wedgwood transformed it and gave it a position of world leadership that it held for two centuries. Wedgwood, who lived from 1730 to 1795, was the son of a small-scale pottery manufacturer. He thought big almost from the outset. The living embodiment of the Protestant work ethic, he drove himself hard and tried to whip unruly employees into shape. He subdivided the manufacture, painting, glazing, firing, distribution and sale of china, and pioneered many of the marketing techniques with which we're familiar today, like buy one, get one free, and full satisfaction or your money back. Wedgwood is still a thriving business, making an array of styles, some dazzlingly attractive, nearly all very expensive, and setting standards for the rest of the industry. Their factory and museum in the village of Barlaston, just outside Stoke, should be on every visitor's list. It's a modern, state-of-the-art place, hospital-white and ultra-clean inside. The days of potter's rot, the lung disease pottery workers used to contract from the toxic dust of the business, are long gone. The factory tour takes you along a series of elevated walkways from which you can look down to watch each stage of the manufacture. At the beginning, one workman places lumps of clay in moulds. Machines shape it into cups, plates, teapots and jugs. Then they're sent into vast kilns that fire them at temperatures over 1,000 degrees centigrade. The next stage is painting and decorating, and here the tour descends to ground level so that you can actually stand next to the skilled workers, mainly women, who are giving them the distinctive Wedgwood look. They're happy to chat as they work and explain the various problems they need to master. The uniformity of their gilding and flower painting is astonishing. Until you watch them, you assume it must be done by machine. At the conclusion of the tour, you even see craftsmen and craftswomen making elaborately shaped vases on traditional potter's wheels. For some shapes, there's still no better way. The ease and confidence with which they do it belies the actual difficulties involved. Anyone who's tried to make a clay pot knows what I mean. The museum that's attached to the factory is a gem, guiding you through the stages of Wedgwood's innovations, his painstakingly thorough experiments, and his sharp eye for changing fashions among the British upper classes, whose patronage he cultivated. He experimented tirelessly to get the right blend of materials, the right temperature in firing, the right glazes, and the right colours. In the museum, an immense wooden filing cabinet still contains the thousands of samples he generated during these experiments. Incidentally, Wedgwood's famous old factory was about 5 miles up the canal in Etruria. Its remains stand beside a museum of the china industry that's housed in an old bone-grinding mill with working steam engines. This too must be part of your visit. Don't be deterred by the fact that you'll probably encounter junked cars and builders' rubbish in the area. The Etruria factory stands at the confluence of two canals, and that's no coincidence. Wedgwood was plagued in the early days of his business by poor communications. Britain's roads were terrible in the mid-18th century, and china sent by pack horse was likely to break or be stolen. No wonder he was a fervent advocate for canals, or that he volunteered to be unpaid treasurer of the Trent and Mersey Canal scheme, which transformed the situation for the better in the 1770s. Horses pacing along the canal bank could tow barges carrying 50 times their own weight. Once the canal was finished, Wedgwood's raw materials could come in and his finished product flow out far more easily than ever before. Where the canals meet stands a statue of James Brindley, the canal building genius who turned the idea into a reality. I talk more about Brindley and canals in general in my lecture on sites associated with the Industrial Revolution. Birmingham, in the heart of the Midlands, is Britain's second largest city, and I'd like to invite Paul to say a word or two about it.
I'd love to, Patrick. Birmingham's people are known as Brummies, and the local accent is strong. Like Stoke, it's a canal crossroads, and the transformation of the canals from commercial to leisure use has transformed the landscape around them. Gas Street Basin has an unpropitious sound, doesn't it? But this area, formerly of wharves, warehouses, muck and profanity, has been transformed into an upscale shopping district with cafes, restaurants, dance troupes, theatres, and the hall in which the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra performs to world-class standards. The area radiates civic pride.
Birmingham has been through successive changes in the last century. It was the constituency of Joseph Chamberlain, a high-minded liberal mayor in the mid-19th century, who aimed to improve the lives of his mainly poor constituents. A passionate advocate of universal education and free trade, Chamberlain made his fortune as a manufacturer of screws, then devoted himself to public service. He went on to play a major and controversial role in late Victorian and Edwardian politics. It was his son Neville Chamberlain who half a century later was the great advocate of appeasement, famously deceived by Hitler's false promises. The Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery is a superb Victorian building that opened in 1885. It stands, aptly enough, on Chamberlain Square. Its clock tower, faintly reminiscent of Big Ben, is known locally as Big Brum. As you enter, you pass the foundation stone, on which is engraved the slogan, "By the gains of industry, we promote art." A common saying in the North and Midlands of Britain is, "Where there's muck, there's brass," which is the same idea expressed in a slightly different idiom. The highlight of the collection inside is an array of about 30 Pre-Raphaelite paintings, including many of the most famous ones by Burne Jones, Rossetti, and William Holman Hunt. If I had to single out a favourite, it would be Holman Hunt's The Finding of the Saviour in the Temple, in which the boy Jesus, dressed in a blue and white striped robe with a golden belt, is astonishing the priests and scribes by his knowledge and understanding of Scripture. His mother Mary leans forward in relief to have found him. Every millimetre of the painting's surface is sharply delineated, the colours are rich, and the setting deliciously exotic. The gallery has a wide variety of masters too, from Canaletto, Gainsborough and Constable, to Renoir and Degas. As with so many of Britain's Victorian galleries, the building itself, opulent, confident and highly decorated, is a worthy setting for its contents. Birmingham was a major target for German bombers in World War II and suffered severe damage. My mother was born there in 1925 and she was there throughout the war years, spent hundreds of nights in an air raid shelter, and once returned to work in the morning to discover the factory where she worked had been blown to pieces. After the war, the city centre had to be extensively rebuilt. Much of the concrete rebuilding of the 50s and 60s was praised by architects and hated by everyone else. So much so that there's been a second round of rebuilding since then. The results are uneven. Each architect appears to have acted as though no other buildings existed, and there has been seemingly no attempt to harmonise the styles or create a general look to the place. Some high-rise buildings have checkerbox black, brown and white decorations. Others are monoliths of glass. The Selfridges building has an irregular, sinuously curving exterior decorated with circular aluminum discs on a blue background and looks like an immensely shiny beached whale. Worst of the lot, in my view, is the library at Centenary Square, a blue and gold monstrosity surrounded by a weird skin of metallic curlicues. Top-heavy, blockish, and painfully out of place, especially beside Birmingham's beautiful little war memorial, it just seems to say, "I don't care at all about the rest of you." I should add, however, that it won a major award from the Royal Institute of British Architects, so perhaps this is one of the many occasions in talking about modern architecture that I am wrong. From Birmingham, it's just a 25-minute train ride to Coventry, where more modernist horrors await you. Coventry is nevertheless an ancient city whose most famous resident was Lady Godiva. Legend has it that she rode naked through the town in protest against the heavy taxes imposed on the people by her husband, the Earl of Mercia. There's a fine statue of her in the town square, with her long hair artfully preserving her modesty, and a superb romantic painting of her by John Collier in the town's Herbert Art Gallery. A tailor named Tom was the only citizen to actually look at her. All the others averted their eyes out of gratitude. That's where we get the phrase, "Peeping Tom." Coventry was the site of a great medieval abbey, but it was destroyed at the Reformation. Just a few remains can still be seen at a partial excavation. The biggest remaining church in the town, St. Michael's, itself a superb medieval Gothic building, was designated as a cathedral in 1918 when Coventry became a diocese. German bombers destroyed it in a shattering air raid of November the 14th, 1940, in which more than 550 people were killed, 4,000 houses damaged, and most of the central city destroyed. The elegant spire somehow survived, along with a few fragments of the walls, and these ruins, now open to the sky, remain as consecrated ground. Descend a staircase in the old north transept, and you'll enter the new Coventry Cathedral, built in the late 1950s and consecrated in 1962. Some local politicians opposed it on the grounds that the city still had a crying need for basic housing and social services. But a decision by the Home Secretary, whose letter is preserved on site, overruled them and building began. The architect was Basil Spence, and his design has been argued over ever since. It's recognisable in shape as a cathedral and relies on a mixture of modern and traditional materials. It was Spence's idea, a very good one, to leave the shattered remnants of the old building in place and to use the same type of sandstone on the exterior of the new. The best element, in my opinion, is the large stained glass multicoloured window on the south side of the nave, and the series of coloured glass walls angled obliquely into the structure. Dominating the whole is an immense tapestry by Graham Sutherland, depicting Jesus on a green background. From the start, visitors claimed that his eyes would follow you wherever you were in the building. A statue of St. Michael slaying the devil by Jacob Epstein ornaments the exterior. For the consecration, the composer Benjamin Britten was commissioned to write his War Requiem. He used not just the text of the traditional Latin Requiem for the Dead, but also passages of poetry by the famous poet of World War I, Wilfred Owen. At Britten's request, there was no applause at the end of the performance, but critics were full of praise for the work itself. Since its consecration, the new Coventry Cathedral has been prominent as a centre for the British peace movement. Coventry's sister city in Germany is Dresden, which suffered incomparably worse bombardment at the hands of the British and American air forces in early 1945. When I last went to Coventry, the area around the new cathedral's chapter house was fenced off, and a sign warned of falling masonry. Two or three tiles recently detached from the walls were lying inside the fenced area. Very sad. Looking around the neighbourhood of the cathedral, you can see some of the ugliest buildings ever created. One spot in particular can serve as a synecdoche for all the rest. The grand old late Victorian council house, built of red sandstone in a neo-Jacobean style, overlooks a central garden. It's elegant and decorous. But just across the road, a heartless modernist building has been raised, which is linked by a bridge that jams its way into the body of the old council house. The effect is as welcome as graffiti on Michelangelo's David, or 5 seconds of punk rock in the middle of a Mozart symphony. Does Coventry have redeeming features? Yes. Above all, it's Museum of Transport. The city was a bicycle and car manufacturing centre in the early 20th century. And the museum contains over 200 old cars, some highly exotic, including two jet-powered land speed record breakers, others significant because of their ordinariness. I had a nostalgic moment when I saw a Hillman Imp, one of the cars previously built in Coventry. My family owned one in the early 1970s. It now seems comically dated and frail. There's also a rather grand double-decker bus on which my brother Malcolm served as a conductor during his college vacations. The bikes, motorbikes, drag racers and royal cars make up a wonderful and comprehensive exhibition, enabling you to leave Coventry with the conclusion that it's a very mixed bag, but that hope has not quite died. Nottingham, like Coventry, was a bicycle town, the home of rally bikes. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, a literary movement called the Angry Young Men included the work of Alan Sillitoe from Nottingham. Among his best books is Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, about a young man who works at the rally factory and gets into trouble by having affairs with other men's wives. It's an intense, atmospheric work, highly autobiographical, which was transferred effectively to the screen. Sillitoe wrote the screenplay and Albert Finney played the leading role. It was the movie that made him famous. Sillitoe was a cranky working-class libertarian. He didn't like being told what to do or what to think. That's the theme of his great short story collection, The Loneliness of the Long-Distance Runner, from 1959. Lionized in the Soviet Union for painting a bleak picture of British proletarian life, He was invited to address a Soviet writers' meeting in 1968. He bravely used the occasion and the presence of Leonid Brezhnev to denounce Soviet human rights abuses. However, Alan Sillitoe may not be the first name that comes to mind when someone mentions Nottingham. Maybe not even the first writer, because this is also D.H. Lawrence's home ground. But surely Robin Hood should take pride of place. According to the legends, Robin Hood was a loyal follower of King Richard the Lionheart, wrongly outlawed by bad Prince John, and dedicated to feuding with John's henchmen, the Sheriff of Nottingham and Guy of Gisborne. He wore Lincoln green clothes, lived in Sherwood Forest, stole from the rich, gave to the poor, and loved the high-born Maid Marian. It's doubtful that there was a real person, but by 1500, Robin Hood had become a stock figure in May Day plays and revels. He might have been a representation of the grievances of the old Anglo-Saxons against the Norman invaders. He might also have been the embodiment of chivalric virtue, of whom even the Norman elite could approve, at least in theory. The debate among folklorists and antiquarians continues. At Sherwood Forest and at Nottingham Castle, the displays about Robin Hood dodge the question of whether he actually existed. Instead, they leave it up to you to decide. Sherwood Forest has diminished over the centuries and is now just a patch of woodland. However, by the Nottinghamshire village of Edwinstow, there is a wonderful old tree, the Major Oak, estimated at almost 1,000 years old and more than 30 feet around. It's a former winner of Britain's Tree of the Year award. For the last century, its heavy boughs have been propped up with scaffolding. Nearby is the Sherwood Forest Visitor Centre, which explains the legends and all the local connections. The Sherwood Forest Country Park is a 450-acre woodland preserve that features many other oaks of more than 500 years antiquity. All over Nottinghamshire, you'll encounter pubs named after Robin Hood and his merry men. You know the names, Little John, Friar Tuck, Will Scarlet, Alan a Dale, and Much the Miller's Son. There's also a good statue of Robin himself next to the gatehouse of Nottingham Castle, made by a local sculptor, James Woodford. It caused controversy when first unveiled in 1952 because it didn't look like Errol Flynn, who'd played Robin Hood in a successful film from 1938. The man depicted is shorter, stockier, and wears a leather helmet rather than Errol Flynn's jaunty feathered cap. Vandals stole the statue's arrows until, in an exquisite act of historical irony, a latter-day sheriff of Nottingham, with experience in the metal trades, worked out how to use a hard alloy to keep them in place. Nottingham Castle itself was started just after the Norman Conquest and became an important royal site in the Middle Ages. Militarily obsolete by the time of the Civil War, it was converted into a mansion by the Duke of Newcastle in the 1670s. When one of his descendants in the House of Lords voted against parliamentary reform in 1831, a mob of angry Nottingham workers broke in, smashed the furniture, and set it on fire. It was a mouldering ruin for 40 years after that, but was restored in the 1870s by a local philanthropist who turned it into an art museum, the first municipal art gallery in Britain outside of London. Another super building in Nottingham is Woolerton Hall, a Tudor mansion from the 1580s, built by a local business success, Sir Francis Willoughby. Its exuberant style links it to a series of prodigy houses that sprang up throughout England in the reign of Elizabeth I. The idea was to make them sufficiently attractive that the Queen herself would come to stay with her retinue. In the event, Elizabeth I never came as far north as Nottingham, but Woolerton has survived. Purchased by the city in 1924, it's now a museum of natural history and industrialisation. So far in this lecture, I've concentrated on Midlands cities, Stoke, Birmingham, Coventry and Nottingham. The South Midlands is more rural and encompasses the Cotswolds, which have a well-deserved reputation for exceptional beauty. They're not far from London, Birmingham, Bristol or Oxford, and yet have preserved a relaxing feeling of remoteness and rusticity. Gently sloping hills and a warm yellow stone make the Cotswold towns little architectural gems. Thatched roofs scattered among the cottages enhance an already charming scene. Boughton on the Water, for example, has a shallow river, the Windrush, running right through its main street, crossed by a series of elegant low bridges. Ducks paddle about in the shallow water, graceful trees cast shade, while broad grassy parks give the houses room to breathe, each with its own calm dignity. You can feel your biorhythm slowing down in Boughton, and it's tempting to let the afternoon flow past in one of the pubs or tea shops that dot the main street. Having come this far, however, you should make the effort of visiting Boughton's model village. Built during the Great Depression, when the townsfolk must have had time lying heavy on their hands, it's a superb copy of the actual village, 1/9 scale, but built of the same stone as the actual houses. 80 years old by now, the stone of the models has had time to weather and gather moss and lichen, enhancing the verisimilitude. Miniature shrubs and trees and cleverly managed gardens also enrich the overall effect. There's even a model of the model village, creating one of those infinite regress series that fascinated us as 8-year-olds. My only quibble is that some renovation work in recent years, especially on the copy of the parish church, has cleaned it up too much, making it less believable than when it was darker and mossier. Even so, this is one of those oddly endearing British objects that leaves a permanent favourable mark on your psyche. Incidentally, Boughton has a little motor car museum, but it can't compete with the one in Coventry. A second Cotswold village, very much worth a visit, is Burford, whose main street runs down a long hill towards the River Windrush, here a few miles downstream from Boughton. A Tudor market hall, now the Tolsey Museum, is halfway down the hill, nearly all of whose houses are made of the same warm stone. Wisteria grows lavishly over the cottages, coming out bright mauve in May and June. The town thrived in the late Middle Ages as a centre of the wool trade, and prosperous merchants built a 3-storey gatehouse and chapel at the local church of St. John the Baptist in thanks for their good fortune. You're aware, as a visitor, of the many times this church has been restored, extended and repurposed. Lots of interesting elements don't really add up to a coherent whole. The highlight is an elaborate tomb for Sir Lawrence and Lady Tanfield, local residents from the early 1600s, who were also important at the court of King James I. Effigies of the couple lie side by side with hands crossed, while statues of their grandson and daughter kneel, one at each end, in prayerful vigil. The effect is stiff, slightly comical, and takes on a new dimension when you learn from the church guidebook that the couple were bitterly unpopular and that the townsfolk burned his lordship in effigy each year for the next 200 years. I mentioned in a previous lecture that, at the end of the English Civil War, the new model army became radicalised and that some of its members, the Levellers, favoured a drastic democratic approach to politics based on the principle of one man, one vote. Burford was the scene of a mutiny in the army's ranks, led by the Levellers. Commander Oliver Cromwell reacted by arresting 340 of them and imprisoning them in the church. One scratched his name in the stone of the font, where you can still read, Anthony Sedley, 1649, prisoner. 3 of the ringleaders were led out and shot by firing squad, while the rest were forced to watch from the church's roof. This was the moment when Cromwell's flirtation with radical social change came to an end and set him on the road to military dictatorship. A third of these precious villages is Broadway, 20 miles further north, sometimes referred to as the Jewel of the Cotswolds. Before you get there, stop on a nearby hilltop to admire Broadway Tower. It's a fake Saxon tower, or folly, built by James Wyatt in the 1790s for Lady Coventry, who lived 20 miles away and wondered whether she'd be able to see the hill from her home in Worcester. In the 19th century, one of the Pre-Raphaelite artists, Edward Burne-Jones, rented it for a while as a studio. William Morris, a leader of the arts and crafts movement, often visited too in the 1870s. He liked it so much that it inspired him to found the Society for the Protection of Ancient